Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. The show is 5 years in running, and I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, talking about the science, the policy, the communities who are affected and engaged and involved, and what we can do to protect our food, health, and environment. And that's the theme of Connect the Dots. Every week on the show, we have different advocates, experts, authors, thought leaders, scientists, all kinds of different people who cover different facets of all the things that go on in our world that affect our well-being and health. And as many long-term listeners know, I've been a lead reporter in the fractivist movement since about 2009, regularly covering fracking and awakening people to its dangers on the Huffington Post, Alternet, and Truthdig, and a host of other outlets, as well as on this radio program very regularly. So I'm especially thrilled today to revisit this issue, which is the one that really drafted me from writing about personal health and all the wonderful things we can do, to really looking at how what goes on in our world affects all of us and is something that we critically must be engaged with. We can't assume that food, water, air, and earth, the rights to the right health care, the rights to a stable and ecologically balanced habitat are all just kind of there and givens if we don't get engaged to protect them. And that's the ongoing theme of almost everything we do here on Connect the Dots. So today I'm delighted to go back into the fracking issue, even though we very fortunately were able to get a ban in New York State, where I reside, against actively fracking here. Fracking is continuing. It's continuing nationally. It's continuing globally. We have pipelines. The fight for healthier sources of energy and keeping fossil fuels in the ground to protect our climate is far from over. So on today's show, I'm delighted to welcome filmmaker John Bauermaster, who is the director of this wonderful film, Dear President Obama, and we'll be talking with him about his work as a documentary filmmaker and a environmentalist and conservationist, as well as about the film and what it really teaches us. And so I love the film. I'll just say that right away. I think it's a terrific film. And delighted to welcome John Bauermaster to Connect the Dots.
Yeah, thank you, Allison. Pleasure to be with you.
So, you know, you have a really incredible biography. You have been a grantee of the National Geographic Expeditions Council. You're one of the Society's ocean heroes. You have documented the Antarctica crossing it by dog sled, written dozens of books, and produced and directed more than 15 documentary films. Your company is called Oceans 8, so your passion for water and the ocean is, I would guess, is what brought you to engagement and covering the issue of fracking. Do you have any more personal reasons why you made this film and got involved before we talk more about the film?
Well, you know, my training, my experience is as a journalist. I have a couple degrees and which were focused on reporting on politics and government, going back to Washington, D.C., where I went to graduate school. And so everything I've done since then, whether it's been in the great outdoors or these kayaking expeditions we did, to the stuff I do here locally in the Hudson Valley of New York where I live, has an environmental backstory or the story is an environmental story. Everything I do has an environmental story connected to it. So that hasn't really changed. What has changed is I started as a print journalist. I wrote for kind of any magazine you can think of. I've done a dozen books ranging, you know, mostly on politics and remote corners of the world. I do have this long relationship with National Geographic, and you're right, my first assignment for National Geographic was in 1988 to write about a dog sled expedition that went across Antarctica, the longest crossing of the continent ever, 3,741 miles in 221 days. But, you know, even the intent of that expedition was to draw attention to Antarctica at a time that the treaty that governs it was being renegotiated, and we wanted to make sure that it stayed pristine and did not get divvied up into the hands of countries looking for resources, which, you know, I've been back to Antarctica many times. I've made a couple more films there, and that's still a big issue. So, but the interesting thing for me is having gone from that kind of big global look at the world and writing about, you know, the most remote continent on the planet to doing really interesting and provocative work in my backyard here in New York State, which obviously includes this fracking reporting, which for me began in 2011.
You know, it's funny because we go out and we are, you know, many people are now teaching that it's really important for everyone, and it's self-evident for people who love nature, but many people, like kids growing up in the inner city, for example, don't have a connection, an easy way to connect to nature, apart from maybe in some park spaces and all of that. And people have been studying and finding out how incredibly important that is. And yet, and, you know, I feel very privileged to have had, many years of connection to nature, you know, through this one beautiful spot on Earth where my family, had a home and everything and still continues. But, you know, many people don't have that. But it's strange because when we go out into the wildness of nature, it really relieves for us just, you know, it's a living reminder of a deeper connection, you know, that we sometimes can forget about with our very complex civilization. And yet, when we then turn around and realize that our complex civilization is actually affecting the natural world as it is, what is originally just kind of an immersion into a kind of deeper connection, with a deeper level of being through nature, then becomes a recruitment into protecting the source of life which we care about. And in this particular moment of civilization, that is it's a big job. There are many different fronts in which mankind is kind of troubling the water, so to speak. your overall thoughts on that before, you know, because of your broad spectrum of your background, I'd love to hear your thoughts about that before we go on to discuss the film.
Well, you know, I do lots of public speaking, and I'm out in front of lots of different kinds of crowds, and I always remind people that you don't have to go halfway around the world to find interesting stories about, you know, things that are impacting your neighborhood, your where you live. You know, I've had the good fortune to you know, we've made films literally on every continent. I've been probably to 90 plus countries. I really feel like I have a pretty good feel for the world, but what I like most is that kind of more micro focus on where I live. Part of that's the aging process. You know, I'm not 30 anymore. I don't have the same wanderlust. I'm happy to work closer to home. We still go out there and travel and find, interesting stories in faraway places, but the bringing, you know, and being able to kind of share those stories with my neighbors. We've just finished, or not, actually it's not even finished, it's a work in progress that started about a year ago called The Hudson River, A River at Risk, which is a web series, lives at HudsonValleyRiverAtRisk.com, and it's short videos, kind of 5 to 10 minute long videos about some of the risks still impacting the Hudson Valley and the Hudson River, despite the fact that incredible energies have been put into the river to clean it up in the last 30 years. But there still are concerns. But I've been screening that a lot around the Hudson Valley. And you know, my takeaway when I screen a film or do a talk is if one person, and oftentimes it's more than one, but if one person comes up and says, I had no idea or I learned something, you know, that's all I need. I mean, I really regard my work these days as an educator and increasingly as an advocate. You know, I do wear a journalist hat on occasion, but a lot of these films that we're making, they wouldn't kind of fall under the category of objectivity. You know, in this new movie, Dear President Obama, we didn't go out and seek the gas and oil industry's comment because I pretty much, having been reporting on that for 30 plus years, I kind of know what they'd say. So it wouldn't be probably truthful or helpful. So I feel pretty confident in being able to skip that.
One of the I know what you're talking about, and having direct and we can talk about that more as the show progresses too, because I was contemplating that, how different it is for people who are journalists or in at-risk communities due to fossil fuel extraction of one kind or another, and of course fracking falls right into that category, people who've had that direct frontline experience, for you know, all those communities or people like us who have had that experience, the role of money in politics and the role of industry influence over government officials takes on a whole new meaning, you know, when you've actually become more deep dish engaged with an industry like the gas and oil industry, and then they're not the only industry, but, you know, that's the one we're talking about today. And so that's really different than if, you know, you haven't had that engagement, and you can imagine, you know, the impact that a government official might have. One of the things that, as being more powerful maybe than what they're actually seeming to be doing in the face of these very powerful industries. And actually, for that very reason, I love the way dear President Obama begins, because you have a whole series of clips of the president talking about energy policy and the environment in so many contradictory ways. By taking a clip from here and a clip from there, he's basically all across the board, as the film depicts, saying so many different things that all contradict each other and are incompatible with each other. And yet the inclination, especially with a very likable president like President Obama, or with any elected official that we trust or would like to trust, the sense is, if we hear him say what we want to hear, the sense is that, you know, that statement was made for all time and his heart is in the right place and it's going to happen. And yet, you know, he has to balance, or he thinks he has to balance, or he is balancing many different conflicting needs, the needs of industry, which may be in direct conflict with achieving climate change goals or protecting communities or doing other things. I welcome your perspective on that issue. And I think it's really helpful, as you do in the film, to put it all in one place, so that, because, you know, there's an episodic quality to the news timeline, you know, what's happening today, what's showing up as the news story of the day. And it's harder to do what the film does, which is really synthesize a takeaway from that. So what, you know, how would you hope that viewers would regard, you know, these contradictory statements about energy and the environment from President Obama or from any elected official?
Yeah, well, you know, the film is obviously nominally targeting President Obama, but it's really at its gut aimed at every elected official in the country and whomever the next president is. But, you know, with Obama, we really just looked at his two terms. We didn't even go back to when he was a state senator in Illinois, to check out what he was saying about environmental issues. And then we found clips from the course of his two terms, that in which he was talking about his views on energy. And a couple things. One is, I think he evolved. He has evolved during his presidency in regard to environmental issues. And also, you know, during his first term, I mean, he was just belabored with wars and a crashed economy and Republicans who hated everything he stood for and hated him. And I think he and his team knew that if they made a big deal out of environmental issues that first term, that would hurt him in a presidential election. So I think they were pretty quiet during that first term. And, you know, it coincided. And we have Tony Agrafi in our film talking about this. His presidency coincided with this new found technology, hydraulic fracturing. And he was being told, President Obama was being told soon after he took office, that he was the luckiest president ever elected, because there was this new boom in homegrown energy that was going to, you know, make it allow for the United States to move away from dependence on foreign oil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was going to be cheap. It was clean. It was natural, et cetera. And President Obama, like many politicians across the country, and to be honest, many environmentalists fell for it because it sounded great. natural gas. It's clean. It's cheap. It's, you know, it comes from our ground. We don't have to ship it from evil empires across the oceans, et cetera. And as a result, he adopted this what he very openly called an all of the above energy policy, in which he wanted a little bit of everything. In his first year in office, he talked about, you know, wanting to invest more in nuclear. He wanted to expand what even he then called clean coal, et cetera. He boasted about having, you know, 100 years of natural gas. Made that boast in two consecutive State of the Union addresses. But mm-hmm. then by the time he gets to his second term, I think he's starting to realize that coal is bad, and he goes through a whole big effort to get rid of coal. They completely, after Fukushima, they completely dropped the notion that there should be a new boom in nuclear energy. He starts talking a lot more about climate change and the U.S.'s role in both creating the emissions that contribute to a change, a warming climate, but also how the United States, you know, by working with China and India and others, can lead. And he, you know, when they went to Paris last December for this COP21 meeting, Obama emerged as a real leader on climate change issues. So I think he, you know, he's learned a lot. When you think of President Obama, you know, you don't think of him really in the great outdoors. Ironically, last weekend he went to Yosemite to celebrate the national mm-hmm. parks. But traditionally, mm-hmm. you know, you think of him playing basketball, or, you know, he's more of an urban guy. You don't mm-hmm. think of him in hiking boots out in the forest. But I think he's really evolved during his tenure, and I think on many fronts, you know, we're going to miss him. But mm-hmm. we do have, and the film concludes with some very specific asks, things that this president can do before he leaves office in regard to extreme energy extraction. He, you know, this move to renewables, as you see from the clips in our film, he gets it. He knows that that's where we have to go. But as you say, it's a huge juggle, and he's got so many, you know, groups and people he's trying to appease from the Oval Office that, you know, we're just lucky that he's emerged on a right path.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that the film astoundingly portrays is the fact, you know, that coal, which was always regarded as the most polluting of the energy sources, and which, as you point out, we, you know, that is basically being eliminated and shut down, that actually so-called natural gas, shale gas, is in fact dirtier than coal. That's a, you know, kind of an astounding piece of news, especially as we've been told. I mean, recently I was looking at a boiler in a New York building with someone, and they were like, well, it's gas, and so it's clean, cleaner than anything, you know. And so there's this idea that that gas is clean, but that's, you know, that's not what the film portrays. Can you explain to people why that is?
Well, it's ironic. This week I'm spending the week in Aspen, Colorado at a conference called the American Renewable Energy Conference, and a lot of mm-hmm. kind of interesting thinkers on environmental issues, specifically on alternatives. But yesterday they hosted a panel with a fellow named T. Boone Pickens, who you know, long time oil man, and really in many respects was one of the forerunners in pushing the U.S. into this natural gas boom. He was one of the first ones to promote hydraulic fracturing and make these pronouncements that we had 100, 150, 200 years of natural gas. And it was interesting because I watched him and a couple other people on this panel talk about, they still continue to talk about natural gas as the clean alternative. And I hoped that we were showing dear President Obama here this week. I hope those fellows on that panel come, because it's pretty, it's not proverbial rocket science, but it's pretty clear that what we call natural gas, which is, truth be told, almost 100% methane, which is a toxic gas, is dirtier in the short term emissions, especially when it comes to climate change. The problem with natural gas is that it all the way along that process of extracting it from below the ground, bringing it up, putting in pipes and transporting across the country, at every juncture it leaks, and it leaks badly. And you see in the film, we use lots of infrared photography to show where methane leaks all along that route. And it's unbelievable when you see just how much methane is escaping into the air. And that methane is far more harmful over a short term, over 20 years, than carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in helping to create this blanket in the atmosphere that's helping to warm the planet. So this notion that it's clean, a clean fuel, is just not true. And the other thing, and these guys yesterday were saying it too, is they continued to promote this notion that natural gas is a quote unquote bridge fuel that's going to take us to renewables. But as Tony Ingraffia points out in the film, you know, the idea of a bridge is it takes you from a place you are to a place you want to be over a place you don't want to be. So why would you use more fossil fuels to get away from fossil fuels? It just doesn't make sense.
It's not only why would you use them, but why would you spend billions of dollars creating infrastructures and building them out, you know? I mean,
right.
It's not like you could just freely use them and it's just, you know, coming up out of the gas spigot in your basement or something like that. It's like, you know, there's a huge amount of infrastructure and a huge investment, and why not? If you want to go to renewables, shift the investment into renewables. I mean, is, you know, big question there.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the most astounding figures to come out in the last 6 months or so is how many drill rigs there were a year ago and how many there are today. It's dropped by about 80% of active drilling rigs in the United States because the price of oil and gas has dropped so low. Now, the conversation we had yesterday was that will come back. You know, that those prices, the price of oil and gas will come back, and that that infrastructure will get used again if it can survive. I mean, a lot of these companies in North Dakota and Texas and Oklahoma and Pennsylvania are folding up and walking away, laying off people, closing their rigs. So it's, you know, I, the argument of the film and my argument when I look at all these fossil fuel stories is just in regard to an alternative energy future. What are we waiting for? You know, ever since man could stand on two feet, he's done one thing really well, burn stuff. And, you know, we have to move beyond that. And we know it. We know, you know, that solar and wind and are far more compatible with mankind continuing to live as we do on the planet. But it comes with some sacrifice. I mean, to his credit, the one thing that Boone Pickens pointed out yesterday, he said, hey, I'm all for renewables. I totally get it. He said, but he said 70% of the fossil fuel energy that we create in the United States today, 70% goes for transportation. Trucks, cars, airplanes, long-haul trucking, shipping, you know. And he said, you know, just how are we going to get beyond – how are we going to make all of that come from renewable energy sources? It's a valid point. It's a good question. Battery storage obviously is a huge issue, but you know, are you ready to get on a 747 that's powered by solar?
Well, you know, with an aging population and people who like to stay closer to home, you know, maybe we won't be, you know, maybe that'll be cut down. I'm sure the airline industry won't like that, but I mean, you know, you never know.
Yeah. Well, I talk about that all the time, and you know, there's a really great character in the film named Richard Heinberg who works with the Post Carbon Institute, and he's a brilliant guy, super articulate in explaining, you know, where we are in our energy status today and where we're headed. And, you know, he kind of introduces this notion that in order to move to, you know, this is a huge transition, this new energy future. I mean, it's unlike anything the planet, with all these 7+ billion people on it, has ever experienced, to move away from burning stuff, which we've done for centuries. And it's going to require some sacrifice. And part of that sacrifice is going to be staying closer to home, you know, buying produce that's grown, you know, in your zip code, not 3,000 miles away, traveling less, smaller houses, smaller cars, maybe smaller jobs, you know, but all of that in order to really achieve this energy transition, it's going to require all that. I think sometimes, especially in the West, especially maybe particularly in the United States, we live in this fantasy world where we just think that we're going to wake up and, you know, every house is going to have solar panels and every garage is going to have an electric car. And, you know, that's hopefully the future, But man, it, you know, still, if you look at the New York Times every Monday, they run a little box to show what the best-selling cars are in the United States. And every week, week after week, year after year, it's a Ford F-150s and Chevy Silverados, big hulking pickup trucks. You know, mm-hmm. we're not changing fast enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How long has your background been concerned about climate change and the environment? How long has that been?
I'm sorry, say the question again.
Yeah, I don't know why we were hearing that beeping. You know, how long has climate change been a concern and, you know, something on your radar? And, you know, like you're saying, we're not doing it fast enough. Obviously, we've had, you know, groups promoting climate denial. It's kind of, you know, the inconvenient truth that Al Gore spoke of. But given the longevity of your career and the kind of work that you do, you're not a recent conscript to concerns about climate change, I would guess. You have been thinking along these lines and aware of this problem and watched the discourse and the growth of understanding and the struggles therein for, I would guess, you know, for a couple of decades or so. I mean, what is your perspective
longer,
watched that movement evolve? Yeah, I didn't want to, you know, date you by saying specifically, but, you know, I'd love to hear about that, you know, what your perspective is from that long view, you know.
Yeah, that's a good question. In 1990, I published a book called Saving the Earth. It was published by Alfred Knopf, and it was kind of a – it was the same year that Bill McKibben published The End of Nature. It came out actually on Earth Day the same year, both books. And – but mine looked at 14 different environmental issues and their causes, effects, and solutions. And it came out on Earth Day 1990, and every Earth Day I pull a copy off the shelf and go back and look at those 14 different issues and make my own kind of ratings of how we're doing. And you know, climate change even then was the number one issue. I don't have the book in front of me. It might have been population. No, I'm sure it was climate change. And, you know, I interviewed at that time James Hansen, who had just in the last year, around 1989, I think, had testified before Congress and put a name to climate change, put a name to global warming. And he was a NASA scientist who's still out there, you know, very vociferously talking about these issues. And for a while, I thought the only – of the 14, I thought the only kind of winner we had was the ban on chlorofluorocarbons. Remember the big ozone hole was growing over Antarctica every year, and they blamed it on refrigerants and hairsprays and things. And they passed laws and they banned a lot of those refrigerants, et cetera. And the ozone hole shrank over a period of years. Now, but it's still there. It hasn't gone away completely. And if you go back and do a little research on CFCs, on chlorofluorocarbons, you realize that there's all sorts of pirate refrigerants out there. The problem hasn't really gone away as much as I thought it had. But all the rest of the issues in the book are still things that we're battling on a daily basis, you know, whether it's plastic pollution or overpopulation or – I think we've spent a fair amount of time in the book on acid rain, which we don't talk about much anymore. But, you know, that's moved on to, you know, the amount of carbon emissions that end up in the ocean. You know, the ocean acidification is something that in 1990 when that book came out was not talked about. You know, the figure I cite is that, you know, Of all the carbon emissions that go into the atmosphere every day, one third of those emissions end up in the ocean. It's the equivalent of 24 million Volkswagen bugs every day being dropped into the ocean of carbon, which is killing the reefs and killing the shellfish, et cetera. That was 1990, so that's, you know, 36 years ago. Things haven't changed as quickly as we hoped, but you know, the options are pretty grim. So you got to stay out there and you got to keep pushing. I'll tell you what has changed, though, is access to information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in 1990, doesn't seem that far back, but there was really no internet, no cell phones, no easy access to information. Now, if you know, in this day and age, if you want to, if you're a novice or if you're an expert and you want to read up on what's new on climate change, man, you just push a couple buttons and there is more information than you can even possibly consume. And that's mm-hmm. been huge. And so mm-hmm. these things aren't staying static because of lack of information. There's tons of information out there. They're staying static because we're slow to move. You know, that in my work on the Hudson River, we've made a short video about Indian Point, the mm-hmm. nuclear power plant, which I know you know about. And, you know, my question about Indian Point is, why hasn't there been more public outcry? I mean, there are mm-hmm. obviously groups that daily write and post and talk about the failings of Indian Point and why it should be decommissioned and should go out of business, et cetera. Yet it stays there, you know, year after year, kind of chugging along. And, you know, one of the conclusions from one of the experts at the Riverkeeper was just that it's such a big problem that people don't even want to wrap their heads around it. It's the potential to go that could go wrong at Indian Point is so big that we can't even allow ourselves to go there. And I think in a macro way, I think that's relevant to a lot of these environmental issues. They just seem so big that a lot of people it's easier just to go on with their daily lives and ignore this stuff.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I was at a clean energy event that Mark Ruffalo spoke at down in New York, you know, city for a launch of a clean energy initiative, and an old friend was there who is an LED, a LEED certifier, and been in the environmental movement forever, and worked at Earth Day forever, and all of this kind of thing, and lives, you know, within 20 miles, I think, or 20 minutes, or, you know, quite close to Indian Point, the nuclear reactor that is about half an hour north of New York City, that I've written about and blogged about and had numerous programs about, because they're now running a gas pipeline through this aging infrastructure that has one of the worst safety records in the country. And I mentioned the situation with the plant to this person, an environmentalist, completely unaware of it, and really in the immediate danger zone. I think one of the things, too, is that, and that's one of the reasons why the theme of this program is Connect the Dots, is there are so many different issues, and it's really a full-time job for people to focus on whichever one they're focusing on, whether it's divestment, whether it's fracking, whether it's pipelines, whether it's the trade agreements, which is another big issue that I cover and am very concerned about. And it's really hard to – the bigger the issue and the more kind of – you know, the ones that you have to kind of put at the number one priority level, and certainly climate change is, you know, it's right up there. It may be the number one issue. I would say it is, you know. One can become distracted as well, because everything's a priority, you know, to somebody. This is and should be and is in reality a priority to everybody. And yet, because I don't believe, and this is coming, you know, from somebody who's covered health, you know, for decades, I don't think we're neurologically wired to be able to cope with this so easily. You know, we want to focus on the day-to-day, what's in our immediate environment. You know, it's kind of like, well, if everyone would just recycle as I do or grow tomatoes in their own backyard so they don't have to be shipped from across the country, you know, that's some small thing I can do. And the reason that we, you know, and these other big things, which really entail acting in politics on larger systems, being aware of what these larger systems are doing, seem out of reach. And I would say that even being informed, particularly for women, it seems to me, because, you know, I think men and women are, not to disadvantage either side, but men or women are neurologically different, and women, may have more reactive nervous systems. And so people just kind of want to tune out on that level and work on the small level that, you know, they've been neurologically geared to work on. And yet we have these huge, systemic level, mass effect, first priority items. And we just, you know, we don't get to them. And I think, you know, fear is also a big part of it. I think that people are afraid, And they're kind of avoidant out of fear. And you know, you can go into if you're from an affluent class where, you know, you could go and have psychotherapy, you could deal with your personal or familial fear. But how do you deal with this level of fear on a systemic, you know, that's affecting everyone in the society and the world? You know, I don't think we're going to handle it by, you know, everybody going out to an individual therapist and you know, working on it as an individual. And yet, also in our society, we're all taught that that's
really
the way you do stuff. No,
yeah.
I mean, it's right. But I've heard people propose that.
Yeah, well, in the reporting for Dear President Obama, we filmed in 20 states. We interviewed 130 plus people and then, you know, a dozen plus experts. And, you know, I guarantee that most of these people who've been impacted by the harms of fracking are not the types who have the instinct or the wherewithal to turn to psychotherapy to help. You know, there's you know, an incredible woman in West Virginia who says, "Listen, most people around here we choose to be poor, but we choose it because we have a good way of life. She says we have a creek in the backyard. My kids go out and play. We have clean air, clean water, et cetera." And then, you know, they came and put a fracking well right next to her property. And she said, now I'm poor and I can't afford the help I need to try and stave this off. So, I mean, their lives are just destroyed by this. You know, the statistic that opens the movie is that 17 million Americans live within a mile of a new gas or oil well. And that mm-hmm. figure is even low because it doesn't include all the pre-existing wells nor the abandoned wells, which are similarly problematic. So, you know, this notion that this stuff is far away or it's somebody else's problem is kind of rendered moot when you go out and start knocking on doors and in these impacted communities and discover that people's lives have really been turned upside down and they don't know where to turn. And I think that's one of the interesting complaints in the film is we have time after time after time, and in whether it's in Arkansas or Texas or Pennsylvania or California, people say, well, you know, the one person who's never come to visit me, my elected official. You know, they feel like that's their first line of defense, the people they vote for, who are supposed to be looking out for their best interests and protecting them, their health, their wealth, their environment, et cetera. They feel really let down by politicians in their neighborhoods and across the country.
Well, I think that there's really good reason for that. And one of the issues that I've noted in the current election is that there are people who have experienced various forms of disenfranchisement. What you're describing is disenfranchisement. And in fact, you know, my public officials, I voted for them, they're not working for me. They're actually representing the interests of an industry. Then you have a conversation, you know, you might have disenfranchisement in terms of lack of access to education because it's become too, you know, pricey. You might have disenfranchisement in terms of the quality or integrity of the electoral process, the vote. So there are various forms of it. And so there are some who are acutely experiencing it and some for whom it's mildly chronic and some who basically kind of may be concerned out of being a caring and, you know, compassionate person, but it hasn't really touched them. And so there's kind of a spectrum. So I think there are probably a large group of people who are intellectually aware and care about climate change, but it's different to really connect the dots between what's happening on the policy level and what's happening in terms of the co-opting of our officials at a level of government and democracy when you have directly seen the situation in your community, as occurs with fracking, versus when, you know, you read that climate change is an overall problem, but you're not, it may actually be affecting your community. You may live in L.A. You may be exposed to toxic chemicals, you know, and methane from the Porter Ranch explosion, which you cover in the film. But, you know, people aren't aware of it, and therefore, you know, the prescription, like what we do to move forward, who we support, what we should be demanding or expecting from elected officials in terms of their service, their integrity, their ability to stand up to a powerful industry like the gas and oil industry, looks very different if one has been in a disadvantaged community through fracking versus if, you know, one has been and doesn't know it, or as far as one's concerned, one hasn't been. disadvantaged yet.
Yet, that's right.
So there's a lesson from these communities that is about fracking, but it's also about government capture.
Yeah, and being involved, staying involved. I mean, one of the things that we've noticed in our work across the country and around the world, really, is this creation of what I call accidental environmentalists. You know, people who are just leading their life, going to work, raising their family, you know, maybe, you know, are observant of environmental issues or that surround them, but not activists by any means at all. They've never organized a march. They've probably never even participated in a rally or anything. And all of a sudden, something horrific goes down in their backyard, and just through happenstance, they become kind of the spokesperson in their community for these issues. I've seen it in the small towns, Peekskill next to Indian Point. I've seen it in urban Los Angeles, where they drill right in the middle of poor Latino neighborhoods, where these people who never could have predicted this become environmental leaders in their communities. And it's really fascinating to watch. You could do a whole movie, a whole reporting series on these accidental environmentalists. Our friend Mark Ruffalo, who narrates Dear President Obama and who is the executive producer, he considers himself the same. And he had no intention of becoming as active as he has in regard to fracking and other environmental issues. But once he kind of gained the knowledge of how horrific this stuff was and how it was really impacting people's lives, he just felt like there was no way he could turn his back. So now he's stuck with, you know, being 24/7 activist on many fronts, which, you know, comes with its own burdens. And I think we all feel that way, is that it does become a responsibility, which I guess is a good thing.
Yes, I'm fall into that category too, without a doubt, because I was just, you know, reporting on health solutions, and then, you know, fracking came, and I was basically, because I was a neighbor of Mark at the time, and I basically realized, how can we be going out in the health community and telling people, eat healthy food, and then we have something that's poisoning the water, poisoning the agriculture that our healthy food, that's growing our healthy food, poisoning the air over our cities, making people sick, and, you know, and up industrializing the natural areas of the country and all of that. And then we're saying, be healthy, like you as an individual can be healthy when we make toxic choices on a social policy level. So, you know, that's exactly been my own trajectory. But I think, you know, it's kind of, I mean, I think actually it would be fascinating to see a series on that, because one thing that I note as a kind of, even though, as you describe, it can be quite intense, it's like once you know something, you can't unknow it. and so once you know that, it kind of dictates all the, you know, the kind of future going actions from there, because you can never unknow it. And I actually feel that both fracking itself and the pipelines and that whole form of fossil fuel extraction are a very important thing to stop in order, and we have to get out of the bridge to nowhere mentality in order to really make the changes to new solutions that, you know, we've been discussing on the show. But I also think that the the level of engagement that citizens need to have in government and the, you know, the watchdog and participating role that we need to play to help drive the bus in the right direction is something that you become engaged with when it comes to your backyard in the way you describe, but it's actually something that we all need to be engaged with. And so one of the reasons I think people are not engaging around these issues is because they haven't they're coasting along with a situation in our government policy where industry is driving a lot of decision making that should be driven by citizens, and there's a big imbalance there, and it becomes apparent you know, through an issue like fracking, where you know, as the people in your film, you know, the legislators basically made a deal with the oil industry. They're not there. They're not accountable. They're not checking. They're minimizing what the public is saying. And this is also a pattern, you know. There's been a, you know, a pattern in the media of kind of minimizing what people might have to say, or, you know, kind of, no, you know, well, you have to prove that fracking chemicals are unsafe, rather than proving that they are fit for, you know, for us to be exposed to. That, you know, that's all backwards.
The one example, of course, that runs counter to that is what we witnessed in New York State, where mm-hmm. grassroots groups of people from varied backgrounds from all over the state kind of banded together and demanded this ban. And, you know, it was incredible to watch the movement grow. And, mm-hmm. you know, there were a lot of concerns. I mean, prior to this film, of course, you know, we made a movie called Dear Governor Cuomo, which was aimed specifically at the governor in 2012, at a point when it looked like, it felt like he was about to allow gas and oil to come in and build some test wells, which we all knew would lead to a full-blown industry mm-hmm. and boom. But, you know, to have watched that protest grow and then actually succeed was phenomenal. You know,
it was.
We have a young daughter, and she would come to the events with us. And for these young kids who saw this happen, that was remarkable, because in this day and age, we are so used to, the individuals are so used to feeling like they have no power, that here
right.
was an example where grassroots groups banded together on a really singular mission could succeed. Was an incredible lesson for not just kids, but for adults as well. And, you know, the Dear President Obama film, you know, one of its, the last state we visit actually is New York. And I've now screened the film in 40 cities, probably in 30 states. And when that New York section comes up, it gets a big round of applause during the movie, no matter what state we're showing it in, because people are so proud and to be honest, a little envious of what they've seen go down in New York. So, you know, it's you know, and you'll remember during that fight, the opposition kept saying, well, this is a celebrity-driven campaign. But in fact, it had absolutely nothing to do with that. It was completely from the grassroots up, which gives every community a hope, I think.
For sure. I mean, I think that New York had, you know, some absolutely awesome organizers, you know, from Sandra Steingraber, Josh Fox is, in effect, an organizer, David Braun. I mean, there were a whole – we just had some really exceptional organizing. You know, I was reporting all throughout the epoch on Alternet, you know, and every piece I wrote one about every 2 weeks, was targeting Governor Cuomo. So, you know, it was like a multifaceted thing with people jumping in where they were and all kinds of different sorts of events happening. And there was – and, you know, and one of the things, too – is that, you know, that I discovered through becoming an accidental environmentalist through all of this, is that activists are actually, you know, the most caring and compassionate people in the world. Far from being, you know, just outraged or angry or whatever, ornery, it's actually a group that if you just met them as people, you'd want to join them, you know. You'd want to be part of that community. And so I see us as a kind of, you know, having had a very early wake-up call, I see us as the heralds of, you know, the kinds of things that we need to be banding together with others and activating on. And, of course, that's also the current wave of our time in terms of, you know, who will be the next president and what will be the composition of government, you know, in terms of elected officials and movements that redress some of these imbalances and, you know, push government further in the right direction. Because, you know, after, you know, December, or after November, really, when the lame duck thing begins, that's when, for example, Congress is slated to vote on the trade deals, which could accelerate gas and fossil fuel extraction, transportation and export globally, and really, you know, worse than every single thing that, you know, that your film addresses and that we've been talking about. And so this is something, if we're putting in, if our government is signing trade agreements that wants to instate this kind of fossil fuel process and expand it globally, then it's, you know, we really need the lessons of how to move forward and make sure that doesn't happen as we shift from dear President Obama to dear President whomever is next. Would love to hear your thoughts on how we do that.
Well, and certainly the concerns about the trade agreement you just described are valid and concerning. The other part of that lame duck period could be, and that's why we're pushing President Obama in the film and beyond, to there are things he can do during that period that would benefit our side, which like stopping all drilling on public lands. I like a lot of presidents too, I'll bet he sets aside a lot more wilderness area. Presidents love to do that in their last couple months. So, you know, fingers crossed on that front. Regarding, you know, whomever comes next, Hillary hasn't had a particularly good public stance on drilling and fracking. You know, when she and Bernie were on stage during a debate and the question was asked them very directly, what do you stand on fracking? She kind of hemmed and hawed and to be honest, came off as kind of a moderate Republican and talked about how, well, you know, regulation, if regulations are in place, but, you know, if states are kind of, the cities don't want it, I won't force it, on and on. I mean, she just needs to come up with a much more succinct response that she believes in. And I think, you know, the hope from the Bernie side is that they'll use this the platform building of at the convention to make sure that the party adopts some really straight answer to what to do about fracking, and we'll hope that whomever the next president is, and at this case, if it's Hillary versus Trump, I obviously there's no question of whom it should be. Hopefully, she'll continue to make it a priority. You know, we are already kind of contemplating a short Dear President Clinton ask to come out, you know, the day after the inauguration, focus on energy issues.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. The hope, as you said, is that there could be influence on the Democratic platform. How much have past platforms really dictated policy or influenced, you know, a president's policy once they're in office? Because, you know, they're, as you showed in Dear President Obama, with all the clips of Obama, you know, they speak to this group and that group and give a piece for this one and for that one and for the other one. In that context, you know, what is there really, how powerful is a platform in any case? Is it just, you know, kind of words that we all hold hands on and then it gets shredded, you know, immediately? Like how much strength does a platform, one that would include some of the elements that we would be hoping for, how much strength would that really have in your estimation?
Yeah, that's a valid question. But I guess just to have something in writing that she could be held, not accountable for, but could be held up against going forward, mm-hmm. you know, a couple of years down the road. Mm-hmm. I mean, does anyone really remember what the Democratic platform said about energy issues in 2008 when Obama was first elected? No, we don't really remember. And to be honest, he probably wouldn't have had much involvement in it at that time anyway. No, but I do think it would be interesting if, depending on how far they're able to go, to get something in writing just so that we have something to measure her efforts against. But the big push is, I think, is subsidies. You know, our tax dollars still go to supporting the gas and oil industry through a variety of subsidies, which is ridiculous. They're hugely profitable. They don't need our tax dollars as incentives, but there are industries out there that do. There are all sorts of solar and energy, solar and wind and storage programs out there that are desperate for government support. You know, the reason fracking boomed the way it did was because the federal government got behind the notion of how do you do this. The oil and gas industry appealed to the federal government for assistance, and they took it into their test labs. And, you know, how do we drill that deep? What kind of tools do you use? How do we refine the diamond tips that are used to drill? And that was all supported by federal dollars. And, you know, there's a fair amount of there's been a fair amount of government and tax dollar investment in solar and wind, but there's got to be more. You know, there's got to be literally. I mean, the subtitle to our film is the clean energy revolution is now. You know, it's not tomorrow. It's not 2 decades from now. It's right now. And you know, it'd be great if Hillary could fully get on board. So, like I say, we'll keep our fingers crossed. A far better option than the other choice. So, I'd say we got to go with her.
Yeah. Right. Yep. That's I mean, that's a whole that's a whole topic right there, which we don't need to cover here, because it's not what we're talking about. I mean, you know, have there been other communities that have been able to replicate the New York Wind? Do you think the New York Wind can be modeled for others? Or, you know, why did it happen here? And is it happening somewhere else? Are there places that are close? Or is it, you know, why would it be harder for other places to attain that? Like, I mean, I'm not intimately acquainted with California, for example, but it looks to me like they have a lot of activities going on there that are highly, highly problematic. And, you know, I don't know what traction they have toward turning that around. I mean, can you comment on that?
There's a couple things. One is that New York had one advantage, and that is that we don't have a history of extraction as a part of our economy. You know, we're not a drilling state. We're a largely agricultural state. So that helped immensely in this fight, because oil and gas didn't already have a foothold. Whereas there have been big fights in Colorado. Communities have adopted their own bans and moratoriums. And the Democratic governor, who happens to be a geologist, John Hickenlooper, has come out and claimed those bans illegal. You know, he's totally taking the side of gas and oil. But Colorado is a huge extractive and drilling and mining state. And in California, you know, Jerry Brown, Mark Ruffalo and I made a separate little film called Dear Governor Brown, aimed specifically at the issues in California. And the problem there is that Jerry Brown, who you would think of as being kind of the green governor, turns out our own governor, Andrew Cuomo, is greener than Brown in many respects.
That's true.
Jerry Brown has no hesitancy in traveling around the world and encouraging other nations to leave fossil fuels in the ground, but he never says that at home, because the third largest economy, California is the third largest producer of oil and gas in the country. It's a huge part of their economy. And so Jerry Brown does not stand up to the oil and gas industry at all. If you watch the California section of the film, Dear President Obama, you know, it's indicting on so many levels. And one of the scariest things is that because of fracking and because of the drought, these oil companies are now giving produced water, which are laden with a variety of chemicals, many of them kind of unnamed, is now being used by California farmers in the Central Valley to water, to irrigate crops, including organic fields or fields that are billed as organic. So California is really insidious. Again, they've done incredible things in regard to solar and electric cars and all sorts of green programs, but they're really bad on oil and gas.
That's terrible.
So the question is, can places duplicate what went down in New York? In California, there have been a couple of successes. San Bernardino County has a ban on fracking. Monterey County this fall has it as a ballot initiative. Santa Barbara County is going to do it, tried and failed, is going to do it again. So they're kind of working through the state county by county. And Jerry Brown, like President Obama, is winding down his role, his life in elected politics. He's got another couple of years in office. I'll bet during his last years in office, he'll make some changes to limit gas and oil and fracking. But he can't do it until he's on his way out, I'm afraid.
Well, bravo to that. If it happens, that would be great. We come to the end of our showtime, and I just want to thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots, John Bauermaster. People can see the film Dear President Obama. How can they see it? How can they find it?
Well, we finished this 40-city tour. Now we're doing a big – if you go to DearPresidentObama.com, you can actually request a screening. And that's going to go on for a few months. And by the end of the summer, it'll be up on the web, so people are going to watch it at Amazon and iTunes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Great. Fantastic film. Thank you so much for this film and your many years of terrific work on this really vital front. Thank you for coming and joining us on the show. And everyone, go see dear President Obama. Thank you, John Bauermaster.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us for the latest edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back with you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.